you know, the world has changed, and school has become an abnormal setting for children. And instead of admitting that, we say the children are abnormal. We say the children, we need to correct the children.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason. Today we're talking with Peter Gray. He's a psychologist at Boston College, and he writes a lot about childhood and the loss and decline of play. Peter, thanks for talking to us.
I'm very glad to be here.
So in your book from 2013, it was called Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. You also did a widely viewed TEDx talk. When you talk about play and the importance of it for children, or actually for our species, explain what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, first of all, when I'm talking about play, I'm talking about what some people would call free play.
Right.
But to me, it's not play if it's not free. So I tend to leave out that.
So this
that term.
Isn't, I mean, specifically, this is not, okay, you come home from school, you're a 10-year-old kid, you put on your uniform and you go to a 4-hour practice that is not play.
That's not what I regard as play. The primary characteristics of play are that it's self-chosen and self-directed.
Right.
Play is how children learn to direct their own activity. It's how they learn to create activities. It's how they learn to negotiate differences with their playmates. All of that is destroyed when you've got an adult running it.
Right.
So play is children's play is a child-chosen, child-directed activity.
And you talk about this in the context of mammals. This play is not something that is simply observed in humans or upper primates.
Yeah, as far as we know, all young mammals play. And they play at those activities that are the biggest constraints to survival and reproduction. So predators play at predation, prey animals play at fleeing and dodging, get away from predators. You can pretty much predict what an animal will play at by knowing the things that it has to learn in order to survive and thrive.
And talk about why, as part of it is that you learn how to escape predation, but you also learn how to create a world and negotiate the world.
Well, human beings have so much more to learn than any other mammals. And it's not surprising, therefore, that what I've learned from anthropologists is that throughout time and across culture where children are free to play, they play way, way more than any other mammals do. And they play in a much larger variety of ways, not just in the kinds of physical ways that other animals do, but human beings play at all. If you think about all the kinds of things that human beings everywhere have to learn, we have to learn language, we have to learn how to build things, use these opposable thumbs. Mm-hmm. We have to learn how to get along with our peers. We have to learn how to control our emotions. Children are playing in ways that promote all of those kinds of things. And they're also playing, you know, children come into the world biologically predisposed to look around and see what other people are doing in their culture, mm-hmm. and to see what are the tools in the culture that you have to master. And children play at those things. So children in a hunter-gatherer culture play with bows and arrows and digging sticks and dugout canoes and so on. Children in our culture quite naturally are attracted to computers, the main tool of our culture. Farming cultures, they play using farming implements. So children are naturally drawn to those kinds of skills and activities that seem important to their culture and play at those things.
Now, you chart a decline in free play, in free kind of just hangout time where kids
right.
are left alone and are self-directed and kind of self-organizing. What are the indicators of decline? You know, what's your baseline year, and then how do you bring it to the current day?
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways that people have tried to quantify this, and it's difficult to quantify. But the historian Howard Chudikoff, who's written a book on the history of play in America, he talks about the first half of the 20th century as being the golden age of children's play because By the beginning of the century, there was child labor had been more or less certainly reduced. So children began to have a lot of free time. And parents, adults in general, society in general, had not begun to usurp that free time for other purposes. Schools, of course, existed, but were not nearly the big thing they are today.
Yeah, well, one of the refrain in your work is we need less school, which, of course, makes you a heretic. you know, you're going to be burned at the stake.
Right.
One of the things that I find really interesting about your work is that it both elaborates but is predicated upon the idea that childhood is kind of invented. We take whatever we're living in as, well, this is the natural order of things, but if you look at childhood in 1900 was different than 1800, or right. You know, and it's different now. There's less free time for kids, less non-adult supervised time. The effects of this decline, suicide rates, what else, and how do we know this is a bad thing?
Well, first let me say that the decline in play has been a gradual decline. Sometimes we think of it, oh, it's all happened in the last 10 or 20 years, but really it's been a gradual decline since about the mid-1950s. And over this same period of time that there's been this gradual decline in play, there are well-documented, gradual but ultimately huge increases in a variety of mental disorders of childhood, especially depression and anxiety. Now, of course, when people hear this, the first objection people raise is, well, we weren't looking for depression and anxiety back then. But in fact, there are certain standardized questionnaires, such as the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which has a depression scale built into it. There's a version of this for adolescent age kids. And that's been unchanged. It's been given to normative groups of young people over the decades, since actually the late 1930s. And you look at that scale, and you look at the cutoff on that scale that would be suspected major depression today, and what you find is there's about an eightfold increase in the rate of major depression among young people aged 14 to 18 or so.
Talk about the multipliers of that, though. Is it that it goes from 0.1% to 1%,
it goes from about 1% to about 8%.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite remarkable, isn't it? About 8% of young people today qualify as
Part of that because depression and anxiety are luxury goods, and that in 1950s America we didn't. Beyond not looking for it or understanding it in the same way we do now, but it's also like we couldn't afford it.
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think it works that way. And the reason I don't think it works that way is that this increase in depression, increase in anxiety, mm-hmm. and I could talk about some other disorders as well, has been pretty much a linear increase over this period of time. And it doesn't correlate with economic cycles. It doesn't correlate with wars. It doesn't correlate. You know, kids are much more anxious today than they were in the 1950s and 60s when we believed the Russians were going to attack us. You know, kids are more depressed.
Hey, you know, the Russians are going to attack us now, right?
So, yeah, that's right. Yeah. We're back to that again. Yeah. But you know, some people talk about, well, maybe it's the divorce rate, maybe it's other things related to the family, but divorces really peaked in the 1970s, and this did not peak.
In 1986, according to a report I read, it was about 13 kids, adolescents, per 100,000 in 1986 committed suicide. It went down to 10.5 in 1999, and it's back up to 13 per 100,000.
Right.
So that's, you know, I mean, that's a 30-year period where you see a decline and an increase. So that fits into your...
It does in a way. I mean, it's interesting that suicide tended to decline. Mm-hmm. Most people don't, even though depression wasn't declining.
Right.
And I think most people attribute that decline to the increase in psychoactive drugs, to suicide prevention programs. A lot of effort began to be put into that. And now, despite the fact that we still have that, suicide is coming back up again.
So
of course, suicide is just the tip of the iceberg. It's not,
And talk about the increase in, you know, when we talk about drugs, I mean, Adderall, Ritalin, you know, Zoloft, all the antidepressants, most of those did not exist in anything approaching current form until the 70s and 80s or even later. How is that factoring into, In a kind of way that would be more akin to a Michel Foucault or a Thomas Sowers, are we medicating our children proactively now in a way that destroys their ability to have free play?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, which I've given some thought on. There's not a whole lot of research on it, but it is interesting that the stimulant drugs that are used to treat ADHD, if you give them to young rats, you knock out play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I happen to have known some kids who are on the drugs, and what they tell me is they don't feel as playful. They don't feel like they're themselves with the drug. That I don't hear that from everybody, and may affect different people in different ways. But one theory is that what the drug does, what the ADHD treatments are doing, is that they are decreasing that drive to play, mm-hmm. that drive to do creative and spontaneous self-chosen things, which then makes it more possible for you to sit in your seat and do what you're told to do. You know, it's really quite appalling that at some point in their career, in their school career, 20% of boys are getting a diagnosis of ADHD, and most of them are being put on these powerful drugs where we don't really know what the long-term effects are.
And do you think that's a change in the background, in the somatic behavior, you know, effect? Reality of children, or is it just that's a place where, you know, a kid's a problem, he's squirming in a seat, he's interrupting too much, so you zap him with that? I mean, reflect an actual physical change in...
That's a great question. I think it's primarily a change in schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember, yep. I described school when I was in school. Nobody expected us to sit in our
right.
seats more than
yep.
an hour at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the world has changed, and school has become an abnormal setting for children. And instead of admitting that, we say the children are abnormal. We say we need to correct the children rather than to correct the space. And it's no surprise that it's mostly boys. Boys have always been more rambunctious, less willing to conform than girls on average.
Yeah. And schools, and part of, you know, part of your argument, which I think is intuitively persuasive, is the idea that school is becoming more and more what I guess nobody uses this term anymore, but it's a total institution. It controls more and more aspects of the people who are in it.
Right.
It has expanded. You go to school early, you stay later, you're in after school or preschool programs, which are basically the same thing. What is driving... Beyond, what is driving the expansion of making sure that our kids are supervised by adults all of the time?
Yeah, I think there's really a number of factors driving that. Part of it is the momentum of the schooling establishment itself. Any kind of business wants to expand, right? You want to be able to hire more people, do more things, you know, and so school has been very successful in that. And I think one of the things that school teaches very well is that you need school in order to learn. And so products of schooling feel like, okay, the way that my child is going to learn is by schooling, even more schooling than I had, right? And so the parents get behind it.
And this is, I mean, it's stark. We don't necessarily look in 1960, maybe 5% or 10% of Americans had a college degree, maybe not even as many.
Yeah.
In 1970, it was probably 15, or it was higher now.
Right.
It's two-thirds of graduating right. high school seniors go on to college. So
yeah,
it perpetuates its own expansion.
We've come to believe that a college degree is essential to a successful adult life. And in some ways, that belief is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Right?
And so... So that's happened. So people believe they've got to get their kids into mm-hmm. college. People believe they've got to get their kids into a good college, whatever
right.
that
yeah.
means.
And in order to do that, you've got to get into
that,
a good grammar school and a good nursery school and a good...
And you've got to take the honors courses
right.
and the advanced placement
you can't,
courses.
The womb has to be pure now. You can't have caffeine or booze or pills.
So you're thinking about your kid's college education before the kid is even born.
How much of that is driven, or I guess what I'm thinking is the kind of panopticon state for
right.
children. How much of that is just the fact that, you know, by 1950, women went back into the workforce in a big way. Female labor force participation was rising until the Depression. World War II.
Right.
Then it dropped, and then it started going back up again. And is it just that parents aren't around? Typically, you know, in my childhood, where it would be common for the mother to be home,
right.
You had somebody to watch the kids, kind of at least absentmindedly.
Right.
When women are working and everybody is pursuing a career, what do you do? Do you really want to leave your kids at home?
Yeah, I think that certainly plays a role in the historical changes that occurred. When women went to work, that was a great thing because women were dependent on oftentimes abusive husbands. I don't want to go back to the
Of course,
most women.
And even if it's just to be able to express themselves through meaningful work,
we never figured out what we're going to do about the kids.
Right.
never, as a culture, figured that out. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, we had this period of time. Women were working, kids were coming home, kids were now in what probably in many cases was a less safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you began hearing, now whether there was an actual increase or not, at least you began hearing more about things happening to kids. And then you began to have public service announcements. Do you know where your child is? You know, and suddenly the whole
if you were a smart kid, your parents had no idea where you were.
Of course not. And when I was a kid, parents didn't want to know where their kids were.
You know, yeah, don't come back until
dinner. They just wanted them out of the house.
Yeah.
And so those things have changed. And my argument is there's nothing about today's world that should be preventing free play for children. It's just that we can't expect it to happen in the same way that it happened in the 1950s. We've got to figure out how to allow it to happen. First of all, we've got to come to some sense of sanity about schooling. I mean, we've really, truly become insane in this drive to believe that children need so much schooling. I think even the people who are pushing their children for more schooling don't see schooling as how they're really learning skills they need for life. They just see it as this is what you need to do to get into the next level of schooling.
Right.
And then you need to do that to get into the next level. And then ultimately at some point in your life, now you're going to be able to get a job and live your life.
Have
right?
you run this argument by the powers that be at Boston College? I can't imagine that silence you.
I haven't tried to talk Boston College out of going out of existence.
Right. So how, well, to extend it, and in the subtitle of the book, you talk about how play will make our children happier, more self-reliant, and better students for life.
Right.
Is there a cost to when kids leave the structured environment of schooling and school-like institutions when they start working? Do kids who haven't played, do they fall apart in a way because they're not used to that more open-ended
circumstance? Well, we're hearing more and more evidence for that's true. And in fact, we're hearing more and more evidence of kids falling apart when they go to college.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, I was invited by the head of the counseling service at Boston College to join him in some discussions with faculty and counselors about what was happening there. And he said that in the last 5 years, there'd been a doubling of the use of the counseling facilities. He believed that prior to that, there was also increases over the course of time. And it turns out that this is not happening just at Boston College. It's happening at colleges across the country. Students are going off to college for the first time, even though they're connected to their parents by cell phone.
Yeah, sure.
They are, in some sense, more independent than they have been before.
I mean, this is where you go to become yourself,
And now they are having psychological breakdowns about things that in the past would have been regarded as bumps in the road of life. You know, we've all got problems. We've got to solve our problems. This is my job to solve it. Roommate disputes, breakup of a romantic relationship, bad grade.
Yeah, I was going to say an A-.
An A-, you know, never got an A- before. I'm not allowed to get an A-.
Before we talk about what is to be done, let me push back in two broad ways. And the first, and I say this as somebody who's written, you know, in a parallel way, obviously a less substantial way than yourself, but you know, we have this ridiculous outsized belief that our kids, you know, the minute they're out of our sight, they're going to be kidnapped and put on a milk carton somewhere,
yeah.
You know, or they're going to die from eating hot dogs right. and get cancer by the time they're, I mean, we just have a ridiculous outside sense of risk. All of that is true. But it's like, come on, being a kid now, like, think about, you know, it's got to be so much better than it was when I was growing up in the 70s. My father grew up in the 30s and was working and was, you know, there were creepy people all around all the time. You know, if you're gay, if you're a sensitive child today, you can read and not be made fun of. Nobody calls people four eyes anymore. There is less beatings in childhood, you know, according to federal stats. How can you really say childhood is a grimmer place than it was?
Yeah, I mean, while I agree with the things that you've described, there have been improvements in many, many ways. I wouldn't want to go back to the 1950s, the prejudices that existed, the physical beating of children was still occurring.
I mean, there was a meanness
and
to
so
American
on and so
culture.
Forth.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, This is really across ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. Children were happier then. And why were they happier then? Despite the fact that their parents might have been less nice to them than parents are today, they were happier then because they were spending lots of time with their peers outdoors mm-hmm. playing. Children are biologically designed to do that. It's as important to them as eating. It's as important to them, to their development. This is what children are designed to do. It's not just what children did during the first half of the 20th century in America. It's what children did during most of human history.
Right.
Part of my work has been to look at hunter-gatherer bands, not directly, but by interviewing right. anthropologists. Hunter-gatherer children are playing and exploring largely away from adults in age-mixed groups essentially all the time from about age 4 to the late teenage years. This is how they learn what they need to learn. This is the natural way that children develop. When we began to take that away, then children were being deprived of something that in their bones, in their gut, in every part of their DNA is driving them to do that. And now they can't do it.
How does how do computer games, particularly network computer games? I have two boys, 23 right. and 15. They have a community around
yes.
computer games, online games. Is that, in your estimation, is that a kind of callback to a good set of activities, or is it too intermediated by whether it's corporations or technology or screen-driven?
Yeah, I think computer play and social media as well is the saving grace.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, our kids would be truly deprived of the opportunity to be kids. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they can't get together in the real world. And they can't get away from adults, supervisors in the real world. But they can do it online.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about what is to be done. You talked about we've got to roll back the school state, the kind of school industrial complex. How do we go about doing that? And then how do we go about kind of recovering the institutions or the social structures that allow for our children to play?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think that there's sort of two different lines that I would talk about here. The first is that if we're talking about conventional schools, we're talking about people whose kids are in schools, I think there's more and more, beginning to be more recognition, partly from Lenore Skenazy's writing and other people who are writing about free-range children
yeah.
and so on. I think there's more, and you read more articles about it. Even schools themselves, conventional schools are inviting me to go and mm-hmm. speak there to parents, to teachers about how kids need play. And they're really examining, should we be cutting out some of this homework? Should
right.
we be putting less stress on our kids? They're beginning to recognize. There was a recent American Psychological Association study that showed that our children are more stressed than their parents are.
Hmm.
that they would rather have a job like their parents than be going to school. They would be happier with that. Parents are beginning to realize that. Wait, you know, we did away with child labor, but we put kids into this situation that in some ways is
so,
as bad
so
as
you
child
wanna,
labor.
So you want to put kids back in factories to help them? So, that's what I'm getting. You want to put kids back in factories to...
No, we don't want to put kids back in factories. But we want to ease up on the factory life of schooling. Give them more recess from that. Mm-hmm. Not just recess, but more time off after school. Recess isn't the ideal opportunity for play because it's pretty much age segregated. You're in this confined space, it's so on and so forth. But we need to... So, and also, schools could become places for play. I mean, think about it after... That period after school, from 3 o'clock until the parents are out of school, what if you just opened up the school for free play? Mm-hmm. Could be age mix. You could combine the elementary school across the street and the middle school and even the high school. They could be, you've got all kinds of opportunities. You've got playgrounds. You've got sometimes swimming pools that could just be opened up for free play.
You're talking about, so the kids are going to be dying. They're going to be drowning. They're going to be breaking their bones. There's going to be sexual problems. I mean, these are the arguments against that, right? That the legal liability, you're telling me here.
This is what people fear. But, of course, that's not going to happen. And you're going to have a couple of adults. You can't have just one these days. You've got to have a couple of them, and you've got to have a couple of responsible teenagers, and they're sort of supervising things, make things are safe.
But, so that's one of the ways to kind of change the... in the character of the school institution. What else do we need?
Well, the other realm in which much of my work is oriented towards, I've been interested in kids who aren't going to school at all. Mm-hmm. Kids who are homeschooled, but who are homeschooled by the method called unschooling, unschooling. I don't particularly like that term, but that's the term often used. These are young people who are in charge of their own education, and the parents do a good job of helping them find what they need to do to pursue their interests. I've also studied graduates of this very radically alternative school called the Sudbury Valley School in Massachusetts. It's been around almost for 50 years now, has hundreds of graduates. This is a school that is as unlike typical schools as you can imagine. All the rules of the school are made by vote, whether you're 4 years old or a teenage student. Kids are not segregated by age. There's no classes offered. If kids want to get together and form a class and invite a staff member to lead it, the staff member is willing to do it. But basically, it's a setting where children are pursuing their own interests in their own ways. And remarkably, you know, we think that missing a couple of weeks of school is going to set you way behind. I mean, here are kids missing the whole damn thing, right? They're missing the whole thing. And they don't have difficulty going on to college if that's what they decide they want to do. They go on into all kinds of careers. There's nothing that demonstrates more clearly to me that we're just wasting a lot of kids' time, making them do all this stuff in school by force, by reward and punishment, which is very inefficient learning, most of which they forget right after the test. And if you don't do that, and you just let, I don't believe you just turn kids out on the street, but if you provide the kind of setting that it optimizes their ability to educate themselves, they do it so much more joyfully, so much more efficiently. And so I actually think that in the longer term, the change is going to occur not by virtue of the schools themselves changing. I just think that the school industrial complex, if you want to call it that, there's so much economic incentive, there's so much momentum associated with it, inertia associated with any real change. I don't think it's capable of the kind of real change that I'm talking about. But I think what's happening is more and more people are leaving it. That's documented. Every 4 years, the U.S. government does a survey of where kids are going to school, and every time they do the survey, a higher percentage are not sending. It's something like 4% now of American school children are in homeschooling. And that has been, every time they do that, it's a rising increase.
So it's the rite of exit.
And so it's the rite of exit. And at some point, I think there will be enough people doing this that there will now be a voting bloc that says, well, look, if we're going to spend public money on education, let's not spend all of that public money on these coercive institutions. Let's spend some of it on providing more educational opportunities so children whose parents can't afford something like a Sudbury school, which is way less expensive than most private schools, but still costs something, can do it.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. That's a great small L libertarian approach to education and child rearing. Thank you. We have been talking with Peter Gray. He's a Boston College psychologist. He's the author of Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. And do check out his fantastic TEDx talk on the decline of play. Peter, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you. I'm delighted to talk with you.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for watching, and thanks for listening.